Master straightens up. Behind his back is a plateau, a rocky plain, and on it shipwrecks. Dozens of shipwrecks, and beyond them a castle. Black, ominous, toothed with battlements, rising up above a mountain lake.
They will perish without your help, O Swallow. Only you can save them.
Yennefer's mouth, cut and bloodied, moves noiselessly, gushing blood. Her violet eyes shine, burn in her face. Gaunt, contorted, blackened by torture, covered by a shock of unkempt, dirty black hair. A foul-smelling puddle in a hollow of the floor, rats scurrying all around. The horrifying cold of the stone walls, the cold of shackles on her wrists, on her ankles. Yennefer's hands and fingers are a mass of dried blood.
Mummy, what have they done to you?
A marble staircase leading downwards. A staircase with three landings.
Weisse Dreier der Beigehen. Something ends. What?
A staircase. Fire blazing in iron cressets at the bottom. Burning tapestries.
Let's go, says Geralt.
Steps leading downwards.
We have to. We must. There's no other way. Just this staircase. I want to see the sky.
His lips aren't moving. They're blue, and there's blood on them. Blood. Blood everywhere. The stairs are totally covered in blood. There's no other way. No other way, Star Eye.
How? She cries. How can I help them? I'm in another world, imprisoned and powerless.
You cannot be imprisoned. Everything has been written, says Visigotta. Even this. Look beneath your feet.
Ciri sees in horror that she's standing in a sea of bones, among skulls, shin bones and ribs.
Only you can prevent it, Star Eye.
Visigotta straightens up. Behind him is winter, snow, a blizzard. The wind blows and whistles. Before her in the snowstorm on a horse is Geralt. Ciri recognizes him, although he has a fur hat on his head and his face is shrouded in a woolen scarf. Behind him in the blizzard loom other riders, their silhouettes vague. So muffled up are they that there is no way to identify them. Geralt looks straight at her, but doesn't see her. Snow falls into his eyes.
Geralt! It's me, here!
He can't see her, or hear her among the wailing of the gale.
Geralt!
It's a mouflon, says Geralt. Only a mouflon. Let's go back.
The riders disappear, dissolving in the snowstorm.
Geralt! No!
She woke up. Next morning, she went at once to the stables without even eating breakfast. She didn't want to meet Avalach, didn't want to talk to him. She preferred to avoid the intrusive, curious, questioning, clinging looks of the other elves and elf women. On every other occasion, studiously indifferent, now the elves were betraying their curiosity on the subject of the royal bedchamber, and the palace walls, Ciri was certain, had ears. She found Kelpie in her stall, found her saddle and harness. Before she managed to saddle the mare, the servants were already beside her. Those little grey elves, short, a head shorter than ordinary Éin Éile. They assisted her with the mare, bowing and smiling ingratiatingly.
Thank you, she said. I'd caught by myself, but thank you. It's sweet of you.
The nearest girl smiled, and Ciri shuddered, for she had canine teeth. Ciri was by her so fast the girl was almost dumbfounded. Ciri brushed the hair back from her ear, an ear that didn't end in a point.
You're human.
The girl and all the others with her knelt down on the freshly swept floor. She bowed her head, expecting to be punished,
I... Siri began, kneading the reins. I...
She didn't know what to say. The girls continued to kneel. The horses nervously snorted and stamped in their stalls. Outside, in the saddle, trotting, she still couldn't gather her thoughts. Human girls, working as servants. But that was unimportant. What was important was that there were Doina in this world. People, she corrected herself. I'm thinking like them. She was startled out of her reverie by Kelpie neighing loudly and starting. She raised her head and saw Eredin. He was sitting on his dark bay stallion, now without its demonic bucranium and most of the other battle paraphernalia. He was, though, wearing a male shirt beneath a cloak shimmering in many shades of red. The stallion neighed a husky welcome, shook its head and bared its yellow teeth at Kelpie. Kelpie, in accordance with the principle that one settles matters with the master and not with the servant, reached for the elf's thigh with her teeth. Siri jerked the reins sharply.
Careful, she said. Keep your distance. Mamea doesn't like strangers, and she bites.
Biters. The elf glared at her evilly. Should be tamed with an iron bit, tight enough to draw blood. A splendid method for eradicating bad habits in horses, too.
He jerked the stallion's bridle so hard that the horse snorted and took several paces backwards, foam trickling from its muzzle.
Why the male shirt?
Now Siri was glaring at the elf.
Are you preparing for war?
Quite the opposite. I desire peace. Does your mare, apart from being skittish, have any other virtues?
What kind?
May I challenge you to a race?
If you wish, why not?
She stood up in the stirrups.
There, towards those cromlechs.
No, he interrupted. Not there.
Why not?
That's off-limits.
For everyone, naturally.
Not everyone, naturally. Your company is too precious to us, Swallow, for us to risk being deprived of it by you or anyone else.
Anyone else? You can't be thinking about the unicorns.
I don't want to bore you with what I think or be frustrated by your not understanding my thoughts.
I don't understand.
I know you don't. Evolution didn't give you a sufficiently folded brain to enable you to understand. Listen, if you want a race, I suggest along the river, that way, to the Porphyry Bridge, the third one along, then across the bridge to the other side, then along the bank, downstream, finishing at the stream that flows into the river. Ready?
Always.
He urged on his stallion with a cry, and the horse set off like a hurricane. Before Kelpie could start, he was well ahead. He made the earth tremble, but he couldn't match Kelpie. She caught up with him quickly, even before the Porphyry Bridge. The bridge was narrow. Eredin yelled, and the stallion, incredibly, picked up speed. Siri understood immediately what was happening. Not for all the world would two horses fit on the bridge. One had to yield. Siri had no intention of slowing. She pressed herself to Kelpie's mane, and the mare shot ahead like an arrow. She brushed against the elf's stirrup and hurtled onto the bridge. Eredin yelled again. The stallion reared up, hit its side against an alabaster figure, knocking it from its plinth and smashing it into pieces. Siri, sniggering like a ghoul, galloped across the bridge without looking back. She dismounted by the stream and waited. He trotted up a moment later, smiling and composed.
My compliments, he said curtly, dismounting, both to the mare and to the Amazon.
Although she was strutting like a peacock, she snorted carelessly.
Uh-huh. Wouldn't you brutally tame us now?
Not unless you permit me.
He smiled suggestively.
Some mares like rough caresses.
Not so long ago.
She looked at him haughtily. You compared me to compost, and now we're talking about caresses. He went closer to Kelpie, stroked and patted the mare's neck, and shook his head on finding it was dry. Kelpie tossed her head and neighed at length. Eridin turned towards Ciri. "If he pats me too," she thought, "he'll regret it." "Follow me." Moss-covered steps made of sandstone blocks stood alongside the stream, which flowed down from a steep, thickly wooded hillside into the river. The steps were ancient, cracked, split by tree roots. They zigzagged upwards, occasionally crossing the stream over footbridges. All around was a forest, a wild forest, full of old ash and hornbeam, yew, maple and oak, the floor carpeted with a thicket of hazel, tamarisk and bramble. It smelled of wormwood, sage, nettles, wet stones, the spring, and mould. Ciri walked in silence, not hurrying and controlling her breathing. She was also trying to control her nerves. She had no idea what Eridin might want from her, but she had her misgivings. There was a stone terrace beside another cascade, falling with a roar from a rocky cleft, and on it, overshadowed by wild lilac, was an old bower, wound around with ivy and spiderwood. The ribbon of the river, roofs, peristyles, and the terraces of Tir na Lir could be seen below the crowns of the trees. They stood a while, looking.
"No one told me,"
Ciri was the first to interrupt the silence,
"what that river's called."
"The Irsnach."
"The sigh? Pretty.
And that stream?"
"The Tuat."
"The whisper? That's pretty too. Why did no one tell me that there are humans living in this world?"
"Because it's irrelevant information and totally meaningless to you. Let's go into the bower."
"What for?"
"Let's go in."
The first thing she noticed after entering was a bare wooden divan. Ciri felt her temples beginning to throb.
"Of course," she thought. "I should have seen that coming. I read a romance written by Anna Tiller in the temple, didn't I? About an old king, a young queen and a pretender prince greedy for power. Eridin is ruthless, ambitious and determined. He knows that whoever has a queen is the real king, a real ruler, a real man. Whoever possesses a queen possesses the kingdom. Here, on this couch, will begin the coup d'etat."
The elf sat down on a marble table and gestured at a chair for Ciri. The view from the window seemed to interest him more than she did, and he wasn't looking at the couch at all.
"You'll remain here forever," he said, surprising her. "My Amazon, as light as a little butterfly, to the end of your butterfly life."
She was silent, looking him straight in the eye. There was nothing in those eyes.
"They won't let you leave," he repeated. "They won't accept that, contrary to the prophecy and myths, you're no one and nothing, a meaningless creature. They won't believe it, and they won't let you leave. They hoodwinked you with a promise to ensure your submission, but they never intended to keep that promise. Never."
"Avalach gave me his word," she said hoarsely. "Allegedly, it's an insult to doubt the word of an elf."
"Avalach is a knowing one. Knowing ones have their own code of honour, in which every second sentence there's mention of the end justifying the means."
"I don't understand why you're telling me all this, unless you want something from me. Unless I have something you desire, and you want to bargain. Well, Eridin, my freedom for... for what?"
He looked at her for a long while, and she vainly searched in his eyes for some indication, some signal, some sign of anything.
"You've no doubt managed to get to know Aberon a little," he began slowly. "You've certainly noticed already that he is simply unimaginably ambitious. There are things he'll never accept, that he'll never concede. He'd sooner die."
Ciri was silent, biting her lips and glancing at the couch.
Auberon Murechertach, continued the elf, will never use magic or other measures which might change the current situation. And such measures exist. Good, powerful, guaranteed measures. Much more effective than the aphrodisiacs that Avalach's servants saturate your cosmetics with.
He moved his hand quickly over the dark-veined tabletop. When he withdrew it, a tiny flacon of grey-green nephrite was lying on the table.
No, said Ciri hoarsely. Absolutely not. I won't agree to that.
You didn't let me finish.
Don't treat me like a fool. I won't give him what's in that flacon. You won't use me for things like that.
You draw very hasty conclusions, he said slowly, looking her in the eye. You're trying to outrun yourself in the race, and things like that always end with a fall. A very painful fall.
I said no.
Think it over well. Regardless of what the vessel contains, you always win. You always win, Swallow.
No!
With a movement just as dexterous as before, truly worthy of a conjurer, he swept the flacon from the table. Then he stayed silent for a long while, looking at the River Esna, glinting among the trees.
You'll die here, little butterfly, he said finally. They won't let you leave, but it's your choice.
I made a deal. My freedom for freedom, he snorted.
You keep talking about freedom.
And what would you do if you finally regained it?
Where would you make for?
Get it into your head that at this moment not only places but time separate you from your world. Time passes differently here than there. Those you knew as children are now decrepit. Those who were your peers died long ago. I don't believe you.
Think back to your legends. Legends about people who mysteriously disappeared and returned years later, only to gaze on the overgrown graves of their loved ones. Do you think they were fantasies? Fabrications? You're mistaken. For whole centuries, people have been kidnapped, carried away by horsemen whom you call the Wild Hunt. Kidnapped, exploited, and then discarded like the shell of a sucked-out egg. But not even that will befall you, Zirael. You will die here. You won't even have the chance of seeing your friends' graves.
I don't believe what you're saying.
Your beliefs are your own private matter, and you choose your own fate yourself. Let's go back. I have a request, Swallow. Would you like to consume a light meal with me in Tirnalia?
For several heartbeats, hunger and a reckless fascination fought in Ciri against anger, fear of poison, and general antipathy.
With pleasure.
She lowered her eyes.
Thank you for the offer.
No, I thank you. Let's go.
As they were exiting the bower, she glanced at the divan once again and thought that Anatilla was actually a stupid and gushing hack. They descended to the River Sai slowly, in silence, amidst the aroma of mint, sage, and nettle. Down the steps, along the bank of a stream called the Whisper. When, that evening, perfumed with hair still damp after an aromatic bath, she entered the royal chambers, she found Auberon on a sofa bent over a large book. Without a word, with only a gesture, he ordered her to sit beside him. The book was richly illustrated. To tell the truth, there was nothing in it apart from illustrations, Although she tried to play the sophisticated lady, the blood rushed to Ciri's cheeks. She'd seen several such works in the temple library in Elender, but they couldn't compete with the Book of the Elder King, neither in the richness and variety of the positions, nor in the artistry of their depiction. They looked at it for a long time in silence.
"Please get undressed."
This time he also got undressed. His body was slender and boyish, downright skinny like Gisela, like Kaylee, like Reef, whom she'd seen many times when they bathed in streams or mountain lakes. But vitality exuded from Gisela and the rats. Life exuded from them, the desire to live, blazing among the silver drops of water spraying around. But from him, from the Elder King, the cold of eternity exuded. He was patient. Several times it seemed it was about to happen, but nothing came of it. Ciri was angry at herself, certain that it was because of her ignorance and paralyzing lack of skill. He noticed and calmed her. As usual, very effectively. And she fell asleep in his arms. But in the morning, he wasn't with her. The next evening, for the first time, the Elder King betrayed his impatience. She found him hunched over the table where a looking glass framed in amber was lying. White powder had been sprinkled on it.
"It's beginning," she thought.
Oberon used a small knife to gather the fish take and form it into two lines. He took a silver tube and sniffed up the narcotic, first to the left, then to the right nostril. His eyes, usually sparkling, dimmed slightly and became cloudy, began to water. Ciri knew at once it wasn't his first dose. He formed two fresh lines on the glass, then invited her over with a gesture, handing her the tube.
"Oh, who cares?" she thought. "It'll be easier."
The drug was extremely powerful. A short while later, they were both sitting on the bed, hugging and staring at the moon with their eyes watering. Ciri sneezed.
"An uncharted night," she said,
wiping her nose with the sleeve of her silk blouse.
"Enchanting," he corrected her, wiping an eye. "Enchias, not enchias. You need to work on your pronunciation."
"I will."
"Get undressed."
At first it seemed it would be good that the drug would stimulate him as much as it was her. And its effect on her was to make her active and adventurous. Why? She even whispered a few extremely indecent, in her opinion, words into his ear. It must have got to him a little. The effect was tangible, and at one moment Ciri was certain it was about to happen. But it didn't. At least, not all the way. And once again he became impatient. He stood up and threw a sable fur over his shoulders. He stood like that, turned away, staring at the window and the moon. Ciri sat up and wrapped her arms around her knees. She was disappointed and cross, and at the same time she felt strangely wistful. It was doubtless the action of the powerful fish deck.
"It's all my fault," she mumbled. "That scar blights me, I know. I know what you see when you look at me. There's not much elf left in me. A gold nugget in a pile of compost." He turned around suddenly. "You're extremely modest," he drawled. "I would say rather a pearl in pig shit. A diamond on the finger of a rotting corpse. As part of your language training, you can create even more comparisons. I'll test you on them tomorrow, little Dinah. Oh, human creature, in whom nothing but nothing remains of an elven woman."
He walked over to the table, picked up the tube and leaned over the looking glass. Ciri sat as though petrified. She felt as if she'd been spat on.
"I don't come here out of love,"
she barked furiously.
"I'm being held and being blackmailed, as you well know. But I'm reconciled to it. I'm doing it for whom?"
He interrupted heatedly, quite unlike an elf.
For me? For the Aeon She imprisoned in your world, you foolish maid. You're doing it for yourself. You come here for yourself and vainly try to give yourself to me. For it's your only hope, your only chance. And I'll tell you one more thing. Pray. Pray zealously to your human idols, godheads and totems. Because it'll either be me or Avalach and his laboratory. Believe me, you wouldn't want to end up in the laboratory and become acquainted with the alternative.
It's all the same to me, she said softly, huddling up in bed. I'll agree to anything as long as I regain my freedom. To finally free myself from you, to depart to my world, to my friends.
Your friends, he sneered. Here are your friends.
He turned around and abruptly tossed the fishtech-strewn looking glass to her.
Here are your friends, he repeated. Have a look.
He went out, the tails of the fur flapping behind him. At first, she only saw her own blurred reflection in the dirtied glass. But almost immediately, the looking glass brightened up milkily, filled up with smoke, and then with an image. Yennefer, suspended in a chasm, back arched with hands raised. The sleeves of her dress are like the outstretched wings of a bird. Her hair undulates. Little fishes dart among it. Whole shoals of shimmering, busy little fish. Some of them are nibbling the sorceress's cheeks and eyes. A rope runs towards the bottom of the lake from Yennefer's leg, and at the end of the rope, trapped in the sludge and waterweed, is a large basket of stones. High above, the surface of the water shines and sparkles. Yennefer's dress undulates in the same rhythm as the waterweed. The surface of the looking glass, smudged with fishtech, becomes enveloped in smoke. Geralt, glassily pale with closed eyes, sits under long icicles extending from a rock, motionless, covered in ice and quickly being buried in snow, being blown over him by a blizzard. His white hair has already become white tangles of ice. White icicles hang from his eyebrows, eyelashes and lips. The snow keeps falling and falling. The snowdrift covering Geralt's legs grows. The fluffy piles on his shoulders grow. The blizzard howls and whistles. Ciri leapt up from the bed and hurled the looking glass at the wall with great force. The amber frame smashed and the glass shattered into a million splinters. She recognized, knew, remembered that kind of vision from her earlier dreams.
It's all false, she yelled. Do you hear, Auberon? I don't believe it. It's not true. It's just your anger, which is as impotent as you are. It's your anger.
She sat on the floor and burst into tears. She suspected the palace walls had ears. The next day, she couldn't rid herself of the ambiguous looks. She felt sneers behind her back, listened out for whispers. Avalach was nowhere to be found.
He knows, she thought. He knows what happened and is avoiding me. In advance, before I got up, he sailed or rode somewhere far away with his gilded elf woman. He doesn't want to talk to me, doesn't want to admit his entire plan has come to nothing.
Eredin was nowhere to be found either, but that was to be expected. He often went riding with his Deir Gruathri, the Red Horseman. Ciri led Kelpie out of the stable and rode to the far side of the river, frantically thinking the whole time, not noticing anything around her.
To escape is what matters. It doesn't matter if all those visions were false or true. One thing is certain. Yennefer and Geralt are there, in my world, and my place is there with them. I have to escape from here, escape without delay.
After all, there must be a way. I entered it alone. I ought to be able to leave alone. Eridan said I have an untamed talent, and Visigotta suspected the same thing. There was no way out of Tor Zireel. I explored it thoroughly. But perhaps there is some other tower. She looked into the distance, at the far-off hill, at the silhouette of the Cromlech visible there. Forbidden territory, she thought. Huh? I see it's too far. The barrier probably won't allow me to go there. Not worth the effort. I'll ride upstream instead. I haven't ridden there yet. Kelpie neighed, tossed her head, and broke into a hard run. She wouldn't let herself be turned. Instead, she trotted hard towards the hill. Ciri was so dumbstruck that for a moment she didn't react and let the mare run. Only a moment later did she yell and tug at the reins. The result was that Kelpie reared up, kicked, jerked her rump, and galloped away, continuing in the same direction. Ciri didn't stop her, didn't try to control her. She was utterly amazed. But she knew Kelpie too well. The mare could be disobedient, but not to this extent. Behaviour like this must mean something. Kelpie slowed to a trot. She continued straight ahead towards the hill topped with the Cromlech. More or less a furlong, Ciri thought. At any moment the barrier will come down. The mare ran into the stone circle amidst crowded, moss-covered and lopsided monoliths growing out of a thicket of thorny brambles and stopped dead. The only thing Kelpie moved was her ears, which she pricked up attentively. Ciri tried to rein her around and then set off, without success. Were it not for the blood vessels throbbing on Kelpie's neck, Ciri would have sworn she was sitting not on a horse, but on a statue. Suddenly, something touched her back. Something sharp, something that penetrated her clothing and pricked painfully. She didn't have time to turn around. Then a ruddy-coloured unicorn emerged from behind the rocks without the slightest noise and thrust its horn under her arm, hard, roughly. She felt a trickle of blood running down her side. Yet another unicorn emerged from the other side. This one was completely white, from the tips of its ears to the end of its tail. Only its nostrils were pink, and its eyes were black. The white unicorn approached, and slowly, very slowly, placed its head in her lap. The excitement was so powerful, Ciri moaned. "I've grown," resounded in her head. "I've grown, Star Eye. Back then in the desert, I didn't know how to behave. Now I know." "Little horse," she moaned, still almost hanging from the two horns piercing her. "My name is Ahuaraquax. Do you remember me, Star Eye? Do you remember treating me, saving me?" He stepped back and turned around. She saw the mark of a scar on his leg. She recognized him. Remembered. "Little horse, it's you. But your coat was a different colour. I've grown up." In her head came a sudden confusion. Whispers, voices, cries and neighing. The horns withdrew. She noticed that the second unicorn, the one behind her back, was dappled blue-grey. "The elders are learning you, Star Eye. They are learning you through me. Just a moment longer, and they'll be able to talk by themselves. They'll tell you themselves what they want from you." The cacophony in Ciri's head burst in an eruption of savage tumult and almost immediately abated, before it flowed into a stream of comprehensible and clear thoughts. "We want to help you escape, Star Eye." She was silent, though her heart pounded hard in her chest. "Where is the tremendous joy? Where are the thanks?" "And why?" she asked aggressively. "This desire to help me all of a sudden. Do you love me so much?"
We don't love you at all. But this is not your world. This is no place for you. You cannot stay here. We don't want you to stay.
She clenched her teeth. Although excited by the prospect, she shook her head. Little Horse, Ihwarakwax, pricked up his ears, pawed the ground with a hoof, and glanced at her with his black eye. The ruddy unicorn stamped so hard the ground shook and twisted its horn menacingly. It snorted angrily, and Ciri understood.
You don't trust us.
I don't, she confessed cheerfully. Everybody here is playing a game of their own and trying to exploit me in my ignorance. Why exactly should I trust you? There's clearly no love lost between you and the elves. I saw for myself on the step how there was almost a fight. I can easily assume you want to use me to annoy them. I'm not fond of them either. After all, they've imprisoned me and are forcing me to do something I don't want to do at all. But I won't allow myself to be taken advantage of.
The ruddy unicorn shook his head, and his horn made a threatening movement again. The blue-grey one neighed. Ciri's head thundered like the inside of a well, and the thought she picked up was unpleasant.
Aha! She cried. You're just like them. Either subservience and obedience, or death. I'm not afraid, and I won't let myself be abused.
She felt confusion and chaos in her head again. It was some time before a clear thought emerged.
It's good, Star Eye, that you don't like being taken advantage of. That is precisely what concerns us. That is precisely what we want to guarantee to you, to ourselves, and to the whole world, to all worlds. I don't understand.
You are a dangerous weapon, a fell weapon. We can't allow that weapon to fall into the hands of the Elder King, the Fox, or the Sparrowhawk.
Who?
She stammered.
Ah, the Elder King is old. But the Fox and the Sparrowhawk cannot seize power over Ardgeith, the gateway to the worlds. They captured it once. They lost it once. Now they can do nothing more than wander. Roam among the worlds, taking tiny steps, alone, like spectres, powerless. The Fox to Tir na Bea Araina, the Sparrowhawk and his horsemen around the spiral. They can go no further. They don't have the strength. Which is why they dream of Ardgeith and power. We shall show you how they have already abused such power. We shall show you, Star Eye, when you leave here. I can't leave here. They've put a spell on me. A barrier, Gaius Garath. You cannot be imprisoned. You are now master of the worlds.
Like hell. I don't have any natural talent. I can't control anything. And I relinquished the power in the desert a year ago. Little Horse was a witness.
In the desert, you relinquished conjuring. The power you have in your blood cannot be relinquished. You still have it. We shall teach you how to use it.
And isn't it perhaps, she shouted, that you want to capture that power? This power over the worlds that I reputedly have.
It is not. We do not have to capture that power, for we have always had it.
Trust them, requested Ihwarakwax. Trust, Star Eye.
Under one condition.
The unicorns jerked up their heads and flared their nostrils. You would have sworn sparks were shooting from their eyes.
They don't like it, thought Ciri, when conditions are imposed on them. They don't even like the sound of the word. Spit. I don't know if I'm doing the right thing. Let's hope it doesn't end tragically.
Speak. What is the condition?
Ihwarakwax will be with me.
In the evening, It clouded over, became close. A thick, sticky mist rose from the river. And when darkness fell over Tir na Lir, a storm sounded with a dull, distant growl. Every now and then, the glow of lightning lit the horizon. Ciri had been ready a long time. Dressed in black, with sword on her back, anxious and tense, she waited impatiently for dusk. She passed quietly through the empty vestibule, stole through the colonnade and onto the terrace. The river Eisna sparkled in the darkness, willows soughed. Distant thunder rolled across the sky. Ciri led Kelpie out of the stable. The mare knew what was expected of her. She trotted obediently towards the porphyry bridge. For a moment, Ciri followed her tracks, then glanced at the terrace beside which the boats stood. "I can't," she thought. "I'll appear before him once more. Perhaps I'll manage to delay the pursuers by doing it. It's risky, but there's no other way." In the first moment, she thought he wasn't there, that the royal chambers were empty, because they were silent and lifeless. She only noticed him after a moment. He was sitting in an armchair in the corner, a white shirt gaping open on his skinny chest. The shirt was made of stuff so fine it clung to his body as though wet. The Elder King's face and hands were almost as white as his shirt. He raised his eyes towards her, and there was a void in them.
"Shaedal," he whispered. "I'm glad you are here. You know, they told me you had died."
He opened his hand, and something fell onto the carpet. It was the flacon of grey-green nephrite.
"Lara."
The Elder King moved his head and touched his neck as though his royal toch was garrotting him.
"Gea me me lunet. Come to me, daughter. Gea me me, Helena."
Ciri sensed death in his breath.
"Helena blood, fayaine away,"
he sang.
"Mira, Lune, your ribbon has come undone. Allow me."
He tried to lift his hand, but he was unable to. He sighed deeply, raised his hand abruptly, and looked her in the eyes. This time, lucidly.
"Cyril," he said, "Lochleth, you are indeed destiny. O Lady of the Lake, mine too, as it transpires. Faese thirayeth epagian,"
he said a moment later, and Ciri observed with dread that his words and movements had begun to slow down horribly.
"But,"
he finished with a sigh,
"it's good that something is beginning."
They heard a long, drawn-out peal of thunder outside the window. The storm was still far away, but it was approaching fast.
"In spite of everything," he said, "I very much don't want to die, Cyril. And I'm so sorry that I must. Who'd have thought it? I thought I wouldn't regret it. I've lived long. I've experienced everything. I've become bored with everything. But nonetheless, I feel regret. And do you know what else? Come closer. I'll tell you in confidence. Let it be our secret.
She bent forward.
I'm afraid,
he whispered.
I know. Are you with me? Yes, I am. Vile Lunen. Farewell, O Alter King.
She sat with him, holding his hand, until he went completely quiet and his delicate breath faded. She didn't wipe away the tears. She let them flow. The storm was coming closer. The horizon blazed with lightning. She ran quickly down the marble staircase to the terrace with the small columns beside which the boats were rocking. She untied one, the outermost, which she had selected the evening before. She pushed off the terrace with a long mahogany pole she had had the foresight to remove from a curtain rod. She doubted whether the boat would be as obedient to her as it had to Avalach. The boat glided noiselessly with the current. Tir na Lea was quiet and dark. Only the statues on the terrace followed her with their dead gaze. Ciri counted the bridges. The sky above the forest was lit up by a flash of lightning. A moment later, there was a long grumble of thunder. The third bridge. Something stole across the bridge softly, as nimble as a great black rat. The boat rocked as he jumped onto the bow. Ciri threw down the rod and drew her sword.
And so, hissed Eredin Breachlas, you wish to deprive us of your company?
He also drew a sword. In a brief flash of lightning, she managed to size up the weapon. The blade was single-edged, slightly curved. The edge of the blade was shining and undoubtedly sharp. The hilt was long, and the pommel was in the shape of a circular openwork plate. It was apparent at once that the elf knew how to use it. He unexpectedly rocked the boat, pressing a foot down hard on the side. Ciri kept her balance with ease and righted the boat with a powerful tilt of her body, then almost immediately tried the same trick by jumping on the side with both feet. He wobbled, but kept his balance and lunged at her with his sword. She parried the blow, blocking instinctively, for she could see little. She retaliated with a rapid, low cut. Eredin parried and struck, and Ciri deflected the blow. A stream of sparks flew from the blades as though from flint and steel. He rocked the boat again, hard, almost knocking her over. Ciri danced, balancing with arms outstretched. He retreated towards the bow and lowered his sword.
Where did you learn that, Swallow?
You'd be astonished. I doubt it. Was it your idea that the barrier can be overcome by sailing along the river, or did someone reveal it to you? It doesn't matter.
It does. And let's get to the bottom of it. There are methods for doing that. Now drop your sword, and we'll go back.
Like hell!
We are going back, Zirael. Auberon's waiting. Tonight, I guarantee he'll be lively and full of vigor.
Like hell, she repeated. He overdosed on that invigorating draught you showed me, the one you gave him. Or perhaps it wasn't for vigor at all.
What are you talking about?
He's dead.
Eredin quickly overcame his astonishment and suddenly went for her, rocking the boat. Balancing, they traded several ferocious blows, the water carrying the resonant clang of steel. Lightning lit up the night. A bridge slid past above their heads. One of the last bridges of Tir na Lea, or maybe the last.
You must understand, Swallow, he rasped, that you're only delaying the inevitable. I can't let you leave here.
Why not? Auberon's dead, and I'm nobody and mean nothing after all. You told me so yourself.
Well, it's true.
He raised his sword.
You mean nothing. You're a tiny clothes moth that can be crushed in the fingers into shining dust, but which perhaps, if it's allowed, can cut out a hole in a precious fabric. You're a grain of pepper, despicably small, but which, when inadvertently chewed, spoils the most exquisite food. Forces one to spit it out when one wanted to savor it. That is what you are. Nothing. An irritating nothing.
Lightning. In its light, Ciri saw what she wanted to see. The elf raised his sword and swung, leaping onto the bench of the boat. He had the advantage of height. He was sure to win the next clash.
You ought not to draw a weapon on me, Zirel. It's too late now. I won't forgive you that. I won't kill you. Oh, no. But a few weeks in bed, in bandages, will certainly do you good.
Wait. First, I want to tell you something. Disclose a certain secret.
And what could you tell me? He snorted. What can you tell me that I don't know? What truth can you reveal to me?
That you won't fit under the bridge. He had no time to react, struck the bridge with the back of his head and shot forward, losing his balance completely. Ciri could have simply pushed him out of the boat, but was afraid that wouldn't be enough, that it wouldn't stop her being pursued. Besides, he, whether deliberately or not, had killed the Elder King, and he deserved pain for that. She stabbed him in the thigh, right at the edge of his mail shirt. He didn't even scream. He flew overboard and splashed into the river, the water closing over him. She turned around and looked. It was a long time before he surfaced, before he dragged himself out onto some marble steps descending into the river. He lay still, dripping water and blood.
"It'll do you good," she muttered. "A few weeks in bed, in bandages."
She grabbed the pole and pushed off powerfully. The river Eirsna became more and more rapid. The boat was moving more quickly. The final buildings of Tir na Lir soon lay behind her. She didn't look back. First, it became very dark, for the boat had passed into an old forest, among trees whose boughs touched each other over the river, forming a vault. Then it brightened up as the forest came to an end, and on both banks there were alder wetlands, reeds and bulrushes. Tussocks of weed, floating water plants and tree trunks appeared in the previously clear river. When the sky brightened up from the lightning, she saw rings on the water, and after the thunder rumbled, she heard the splash of startled fish. Something was splashing and plopping, squelching and smacking its lips. Several times, not far from the boat, she saw large glowing eyes. Several times, the boat shuddered upon hitting something large and alive.
Not everything here is beautiful. For the unaccustomed, this world means death.
She repeated the words of Eredin in her mind. The river broadened considerably, spreading out wide. Islands and channels appeared. She let the boat float randomly wherever the current took her. But she began to worry. What would happen if she made a mistake and took the wrong branch? She had barely thought that when the neighing of Kelpie and a strong mental signal from the unicorn came from the rushes by the bank.
"It's you, little horse. Hurry, Star-Eye. Follow me. To my world. First, I must show you something. The elders ordered me to."
They rode first through a forest, then across a steppe densely furrowed with ravines and gorges. Lightning flashed, thunder bellowed. The storm was coming closer. A wind was getting up. The unicorn led Ciri to one of the ravines.
"It's here."
"What's here?"
"Dismount and see."
She obeyed. The ground was uneven. She tripped. Something crunched and slipped under her foot. Lightning flashed and Ciri cried hollowly. She was standing among a sea of bones. The ravine's sandy slopes had subsided, probably washed away by downpours, and that revealed what had been concealed. A burial ground. A boneyard. A huge heap of bones. Shin bones, hip bones, ribs and thigh bones. And skulls. She picked up one of them. The lightning flashed and Ciri screamed. She understood whose remains they were. The skull, which bore the marks of a blade, had canine teeth.
"Now you understand," she heard in her head. "Now you know. They did it. The Aeon Elder. The Elder King. the fox, the sparrow hawk. This world was not their world at all. It became their world after they had conquered it. When they opened Ardgeith, having deceived and taken advantage of us, just as they have tried to deceive and take advantage of you.
Ciri threw the skull away.
Murderers!
She shouted into the night.
Scoundrels!
Thunder rolled across the sky with a clatter. Iharachwax neighed loudly in warning. She understood. She leapt into the saddle and urged Kelpie into a gallop with a cry. Pursuers were on their trail.
This has happened before, she thought, gulping air as she galloped. This has happened before. A ride like this, reckless, in the darkness, on a night full of dread, ghosts and apparitions. Forward, Kelpie!
A furious gallop, eyes watering from the speed. Lightning split the sky in two. Ciri sees alders lit up on both sides of the road. From all sides, misshapen trees reach out towards her, the long, knobbly arms of their boughs, snap the black jaws of their hollows, and hurl curses and threats in her tracks. Kelpie neighs piercingly, hurtles along so fast her hooves seem only to brush the earth. Ciri flattens herself against the mare's neck, not just to minimize the drag, but also to avoid the alder branches, trying to knock or pull her from the saddle. The branches swish, lash and whip, trying to latch onto her clothes and hair. The misshapen trunks sway, the hollows snap and roar. Kelpie neighs wildly. The unicorn replies. There is a snow-white dot in the gloom. It points the way.
Hurry, Star-Eye! Ride with all your might!
There are more and more alders. It's getting more and more difficult to dodge their boughs. Soon they'll bar the entire road. A cry behind, the voice of the pursuers. Ihuarahuac's neighs. Ciri receives his signal. She understands its significance. She presses herself to Kelpie's neck. She doesn't have to urge her on. The mare, chased by fear, flies in a breakneck gallop. Again a signal from the unicorn, clearer, penetrating her brain. It's an instruction, quite simply an order.
Leap, Star-Eye. You must leap into another place, into another time.
Ciri doesn't understand, but she fights to. She tries hard to understand. She focuses. She focuses so hard that the blood buzzes and pulses in her ears. Lightning. And after it, a sudden darkness. Darkness soft and black. Black darkness that nothing can lighten. A buzzing in her ears. The wind on her face. A cool wind. Drops of rain. The scent of pine in her nostrils. Kelpie prances, snorts and stamps. Her neck is hot and wet. Lightning. Soon after it, thunder. In the light, Ciri sees Ihuarahuax shaking his head and horn, powerfully pawing the ground with his hoof.
Little horse, I'm here, Star-Eye.
The sky is full of stars, full of constellations. The dragon, the winter maiden, the seven goats, the pitcher, and almost just above the horizon, the eye.
We did it, she gasped. We made it, little horse. This is my world.
His signal is so clear that Ciri understands everything.
No, Star-Eye. We fled from one world, but it still isn't your place, not your time. There are still many worlds ahead of us. Don't leave me alone. I will not. I am in debt to you. I must pay it off. Entirely.
Along with the growing wind, the sky darkens from the west. The clouds, coming in waves, extinguish the constellations in turn. The dragon goes out.